You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
This episode of On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Brand Now, How to Stand Out in a Crowded, Distracted World. Many former On Brand guests are already raving about Brand Now. Jay Baer calls it the quintessential guide to modern branding. Stacey Grissom of BarkBox says Brand Now provides practical tools and a helpful framework for building a brand both online and off. Learn more, get special extras and additional resources at brandnowbook.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Lucas Conley. A journalist with an eye for stories that change how we see the world, Conley began his career at the Atlantic Monthly and has written for the Boston Globe, Fast Company, ESPN The Magazine, Spin, and the Wall Street Journal Magazine, among others. Lucas has been invited to speak about his work on the Colbert Report, ABC, World News, CNN's Book TV, NPR, and at South by Southwest. Lucas's books explore the human dimension of business. Author of Obsessive Branding Disorder, one of Strategy Plus Business's best books of 2008, and co-author of The Method Method, listed as a top 10 marketing book in 2011 by Advertising Age, his third book, Legacy in the Making, co-authored with award-winning strategist Mark Miller, was published in March of 2018. Lucas holds a BA in creative writing from the University of Arizona and JD from the University of New Mexico School of Law. A writer with the Legacy Lab, he lives in Los Angeles, California. When not writing, he lights out for North America's most remote and spectacular wildlands. Lucas, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you for having me, Nick.
You know, I took a long pregnant pause there as I said wildlands, because I think I did some sort of... I don't know if it was a Midwestern accent thing, but I felt like I said wildlings from Game of Thrones. So I just wanted to make sure I actually was saying wildlands and not implied that you were going beyond the wall to the north.
The word itself does kind of inspire the imagination, doesn't it?
It does. The wildlands. You know, you can tell that that you do some writing about stuff. Good word choice there. So I have to ask, speaking of word choice, as someone that works in branding, teaches about branding, writes about branding, interviews folks about branding on this podcast every week, tell me what obsessive branding disorder is and how might I know if I have that?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because it really is it's the roots to the current book. It's how Mark and I originally met years ago, my co-author and I. Obsessive branding disorder came up when I was reviewing books for Fast Company magazine back in the mid-2000s. And something we noticed with the editorial team was that branding books were coming in more and more frequently. And it was kind of funny for a while. And then we started getting – it was almost like a jump to the shark. You know, we saw Adam Morgan's pirate branding, or the pirate inside, and, you know, some of these more comical stretches of the concept. And we thought to ourselves, are companies just trying to dress up the brand in different ways? Or are they really trying to get to the core assets of the business and deliver something that customers need? So out of that original thought grew an essay, and out of the popularity of the essay grew a book. And ultimately, Mark and I had an opportunity to talk about that book and began working together back about 10, 12 years ago. So when he called up and said, hey, I've got an interesting project. We have a variety of brands that are struggling with how to celebrate anniversaries, how to look at their age, how to pride themselves on where they stand in their industries. I jumped at the opportunity to work with him.
Well, that's an interesting thought for several different ways, but especially in the kind of connective tissue to the new book, to the new concept there. Talking about legacy, especially, and talking about and celebrating that, and I'm trying to. It's one of those things that when you said that, it feels like it's a concept that there's a fit for, because it seems like as new as we're trying to do everything, it might go against the grain a little bit to celebrate how long we've been around. Then we don't sound as new and exciting, or as, I guess, relevant as we might be. So there is probably a disconnect there, I would imagine.
Well, what was really interesting is, it's, if you think about it, it's entirely relative. You know, depending on your category, age can be a benefit or a flaw, something that people see as a vulnerability. In the case that really sparked the call from Mark was, there were a hotel brand and a car brand. The car brand was dealing with competitors that were generations older, more than a century old, and it was looking at celebrating, a 30th anniversary, and thought, well, if we celebrate this, we're essentially saying to the market that 30 years is something to be proud of, when our competitors are far, far more distinguished in age. Whereas the hotel brand said, about the same age, I think maybe 35, we're competing with some very hot young properties out there. Millennials are looking for the latest, greatest thing. We don't want to toot our own horn about being 30, 35 years old. This was really the impetus for the Legacy Lab, was this sense of how do you talk to brands, how you talk to leaders about bringing the past forward and continuing to evolve their brands, rather than simply holding too tightly to it or abandoning it entirely.
Yeah, because those extremes, I would say that's probably the fork in the road that most easily see, is the let's throw it out and do something completely different, or let's be too traditional and rigid and not really connect. And there's probably a third path in between those that you're identifying, but I would imagine takes some work to illuminate that path.
Yes. Well, you probably see it in your work as well. I think the average tenure of the chief marketing officer now is just shy of 3 years.
Yeah.
So the turnaround is very high. So there's also pressure from the market for people who come into these roles to either not rock the boat. I've only got 3 years here. I don't want to change the formula for Coke and screw everything up. Or to completely revolutionize the brand, take it in an entirely new direction. Over time, of course, that creates a kind of schizophrenia that, leaves the customer wondering, what are these guys about? So that middle road really is what this book is about, is trying to find a way to draw forward the roots of the brand, or in fact, if it's a new brand, understand those roots and propel them. And then also to evolve, to find a way to revitalize those equities in new and imaginative ways that are contextually relevant to the times we live in.
So is there in your work, I'd have to imagine that, there's all kinds of examples that you could cite, but is there a real legacy leader that leverages that in a way that, I'd say most importantly, probably works for their industry? But is really kind of stand out in embracing that also.
Sure. Well, we have more than 20 in the book, and I would point to any of them. I hate to elevate one above the other, but I think it makes sense maybe to talk about Yvon Chouinard, who wrote our foreword. We had an opportunity to sit down with him up at the headquarters of Patagonia. I guess it was early 2017. And, here's a guy who exemplifies all five of the key characteristics that we highlight in the book. He had a personal ambition. He behaves his beliefs. He works with his consumers to develop influence. It's an unconventional brand, and it is constantly evolving its legacy. When we spoke to him, these things became clear because he started telling us about why he founded the company. His goal when he started was to develop better tools. At the time, the climbing tools out there in the 60s were designed to be left in the rocks. So you conquered a mountain, you left your trash behind. He was part of a new generation of climbers that was interested in not only reusing the climbing equipment, but not leaving it behind. And so he designed new tools and as a result launched a couple different brands over the years. Ultimately, Patagonia is of course his key focus today, and has driven that ambition through everything he does, whether it's clothing, which he also treats as a tool, you know, a pragmatic tool, or it's the brand's goals in culture. He has driven the brand in a variety of directions, socially, politically, environmentally, that have really progressed its values.
Well, you know, what I think's interesting, you talk about progressing its values and the goals and being relevant. And I feel like we've been in a run here for a couple years of seeing more socially active brands, especially with different you know, policies emerging and things like that. And it, with some, it seems very, very grafted on. And I think a leader there, it's really kind of a... probably a topic adjacent to legacy, but Patagonia is very much leading that. But I think why it works so well is it's so tied to who they are, that it's not an extra, now we say this, now we are taking a stand where we did not before, because it's really... very much a part of their DNA, a part of who they've been since they since the climbing pins.
Yeah, I think one of the things we recognized in that, that's really our third chapter is all about generating influence. Is we recognize that brands that really do this well don't only have that core belief, but they really find a way to let their customers speak with them and help tell the story. A good example in that third chapter is the It Gets Better project. You know, this is a group that was founded to help isolated LGBTQ teens and share a message of hope. And what they did is they allowed people to share videos saying, you know, sharing tough times that they had when they were teens and letting them know, hey, it gets better. The world is more accepting than maybe the small town you live in. And the result is, you know, essentially a viral explosion of videos that now is translated into television and film. And it was because they handed the mic over to their consumers. And we see this a lot with brands that are successful in the influence realm, is that they found a way to let outsiders in.
That's, I mean, I think that that's... I mean, that dynamic of bringing people in is something that, just like that third path we were talking about, is difficult to do. It's something that a lot of people give lip service to, but in figuring out how to really make that a part of your brand, a part of who you are, is tricky.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people will see about this book is that each of these five pillars that we've written about, it is hard, and we frame them as transformations. And we're very clear about this is the way things have traditionally been in brand building. If you went to business school, if you worked for one of the large brands through the early parts of your career, you'll recognize the traditional format of brand building that we portray in the book. And then we talk about what we observed as we began to study legacy, and particularly what we call modern legacy, which is this more present, forward-looking form of legacy building. And it's a transformational take on brand building. You know, in many cases, dramatically different, and I think very difficult for brands to adopt. In some cases, you know, brands who are founded recently have an easier time with this because they're more adept to the current context. But there are also larger brands where the values are strong that have made the translation to this these new sets of values smoothly.
So would it help to kind of outline what those five pillars are? I think we've touched on some of them, but just in kind of listing them off.
Yeah, absolutely. So briefly, it's take leadership personally, behave your beliefs, let outsiders in, invent your own game and never stop making legacy. And the, what these, to walk these out a bit more, the book begins with a call for more personal long-term ambition. Really, when you look at modern legacy brands, you'll find that they're all founded around somebody's desire to change the world, improve something, solve a problem, make a durable difference in the world. Building off that core ambition, the second chapter talks about behaving your beliefs. And this is largely about the people that, that you gather at your side within the brand. What do you believe, and are you bringing those beliefs to life? Clarifying those values and ensuring that they're expressed through how your employees bring the brand to life. The third goes a bit further out. We talk about consumers and letting outsiders in. This is particularly difficult for modern, or for a lot of companies that are making the step into the modern age, because it does involve a lot of transparency. It involves letting go of some control, and that's an entirely different model for a lot of older brands. Our fourth chapter, Invent Your Own Game, is really about being unconventional. You know, you can do all of this, but if you're in a commodity category and you're not distinguishing yourself in any way, you can be copied and usurped. So it's about not letting your category define you, and not only being the best, but being the only one doing what you do. And our final chapter really talks about being perpetual. And this is another difficult concept, because it's bringing those values, all four of those pillars, to life every day. And we talk about several brands that are doing a great job of drawing the past forward and revitalizing it through through how they express their brand today and looking forward to tomorrow.
You know, I have to come back and compliment even your little word choices. I got stuck on you saying that brands that endure make a durable difference, and I think that that, you know, just a difference is one thing, but something that's durable, it gets back to this idea of enduring, of the overall legacy that we're talking about here as well, that it's not just, you know, selling shoes or a slightly better widget than what's there. It is something that's tied to a bigger idea that, like you said, I think is easier to see for brands that are there. But is there a way that brands that exist today that have maybe lost their way a little bit, that are having trouble finding some of those core beliefs that were once there, is there a path out of that kind of being lost?
I guess I would point to some of the brands in the last chapter. We talk about the maintenance of a legacy, right, and making it perpetual in that last chapter. And a couple of the different brands we talk about are the championships, Wimbledon, of course, the tennis championships that we just had here, and Taylor Guitars. And what these brands do is in the case of Wimbledon, they actually look at what their priorities are. For example, their ambition is to bring the sport to life, to be the best game of tennis that there is. And then they make every decision through that lens. So if they add a roof, which is a very controversial measure they made on their central court recently, it's in the name of improving the sport for the players, the fans, for the enjoyment of the sport. If they add more cameras to broadcast the sport elsewhere in South America, for example, it's in the name of making the best game of tennis. They won't change things that popular culture might demand. For example, everybody wears all whites at Wimbledon. There's no musical introductions for players. There are some very customary things that they do that they keep alive, and they do all this through an annual audit. So for brands that are struggling, that feel as if they're having a hard time connecting with the modern consumers or their past, I think that's one way to begin looking at this process of getting in touch with your legacy, is to examine the equities you have. Are they stagnant? Are they alive? And we actually have a tool in that fifth chapter where you can kind of move through your equities and decide, is this something that we need to continue? Is this something we need to replace? How do we bring these equities to life?
That's great. You mentioned Taylor Guitars. That's top of mind for me. I always, in teaching here at the at the University of Iowa, I always mention the United Breaks Guitars, but I always tell it in a way that involves the Taylor Guitars response, because I think that that was such a it's not always the leading part of the story, but it's the other brand that was in the mix there. And it's a great video with Bob Taylor responding to that. And to me, it's so interesting because it's one of those social media brand crises that we like to rubberneck, and you know, it could be horrifying to involve yourselves in it, but I think that they were already a part of the story, and it, mentioning that in such a human way makes me think of several of the pillars, but it makes me think of drawing folks in too that maybe didn't know as much about Taylor. And seeing some of the people behind it respond to this issue.
And you're speaking about the Gibson Guitars bankruptcy.
No, the I was mentioning. Did you mention Gibson Guitars or Taylor Guitars?
I mentioned Taylor, but I thought you had brought up. Which story were you referring to?
Oh, the Dave Carroll United breaking his guitar, and that viral video as a result of that about United breaking guitars. And it was a Taylor guitar, as mentioned frequently in the song. And Taylor Guitars posted a response. It's years and years ago, but it's, I think, such an engaging brand interaction from them. But that's my...
Oh, that's great. I did not know about that story. I'll have to take a look at that.
Oh, absolutely. And it's because, again, they're mentioned frequently, but they didn't do anything wrong. That was just the brand of guitar that got broken. And they took advantage of this opportunity to talk about guitar care and to talk about traveling with your guitar. And again, I don't play, but I have a very... I feel very connected with that message, because I think that that was a neat thing to, again, to pull folks in.
Well, one of the best things about the Taylor brand is, of course, that the founders are there. They can respond to stories like that in person. And I think that's, of course, more difficult as you have re-founders come in afterwards and try and take on the passion of the original leaders. But Taylor's a great example for that transition, and it's one of the parts of the story that we highlight is the founders have actually chosen their successor from their own ranks. He's one of the master craftsmen from their guitar shop in his mid-30s, and he's going to take over the brand after they retire, because he has the same passion for making guitars. They looked at how transitions had happened at some of their key competitors and realized, if we hand this over to folks who are interested in, you know, maximizing the dollar out of this brand, you know, the innovation is going to stop, and we're going to see cutting corners. They wanted to hand the brand on to someone who would have that same passion to carry it forward.
Well, and maybe I'm trying to shoehorn the wrong parts of your system in, but that seems like a great example of what you were talking about with Wimbledon, of examining the equities there. That, you know, it's yep. Not just about, you know, who maybe has the the pedigree that we would think of as a business leader. It's with a brand like that, it's got to be the right person that can carry on that founder's legacy and keep that alive.
Yeah, it gets back to that first chapter about that long-term personal ambition being the real driving force behind it all.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's, I mean, that's, are the pillars sequential? Because it sure seems like that first one has to be there in some form or another for the others to make sense, for them to stand up, to overextend the metaphor?
Yeah, I think they are. I think that in reality, they all need to be revisited in time as your brand evolves. But if you look at this from the perspective of a brand that's just starting out, I think that it makes sense to start with the long-term personal ambition at the core, the beliefs of the brand and the employees who bring it to life, how that brand interacts and influences the market, how it stays different, and then how it stays perpetual.
Yeah, that is true, and it underlies all of the steps, and really probably the legacy in the rearview mirror as well.
And forward-looking legacy too. I think that's one of the key ideas we try and get across, is that a lot of people think about leaving a legacy, and what we try to really change with this book is that people who are driving their legacy forward think about it in a forward-looking way. They're really trying to advance something in the world and solve a problem or, like I said, make a durable difference.
You know, that is, I think, a key thing to point out, because I did it myself sitting here talking with you, thinking through it, talking about legacy in the rearview mirror, as I said, but that same set of pillars is what guides you and can serve as a compass as you move forward as well.
Yeah, we like to think of it less as a manual and more of as a toolkit.
Yeah, well, that is fascinating. Lucas, as we start to wrap up here, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
A brand that's made me smile. Well, I continue to enjoy watching the brands in the book come to life, and I think the Bluebird Cafe is a great example. It's in our second chapter about behaving your beliefs, and you know, here is a tiny cafe in Nashville that is based around the idea of not only celebrating successful artists, but keeping its door open for singer-songwriters who are just starting out in Nashville. And it's had tremendous success on the mainstream stage as a venue in shows like Nashville. But it's also continued to introduce new artists to the field. And I think that when you can keep those core beliefs, that core mission alive, even after you've succeeded and there are more and more demands for your time and energy, that's just a really inspiring legacy story.
That is that's a great example and ties right to what we were talking about as well. Lucas, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
You can check us out at thelegacylab.com, and we're also on social media at The Legacy Lab on Twitter and Facebook, and we encourage you to reach out to us on any of those platforms.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Lucas, thank you for joining us on Brand.
Thank you, Nick. That was great.
And a reminder, if you heard something that you liked on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. On Brand is a production of Brand Driven Digital, helping complex organizations simplify their branding and marketing to unlock growth. More, including the links we discussed on this episode, at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.